Welcome to the G328 podcast from City Gospel Mission. We are a podcast for those who are working as reconcilers in ministries, churches, and communities. G328 comes from the Bible verse found in Galatians 3:28, which says, "There is neither Jew nor Greek, there is neither slave nor free, there is neither male nor female, for you are all one in Christ Jesus." This podcast is one of the ways we can help each other follow Jesus' teachings and turn away from bias, prejudice, racism, classism, and sexism. Hi, I'm Kara Worden, and I'm with my guest today, Lakrita Bowman. Lakrita, could you share a little bit with us about who you are and what your background is?
My background is recovery. I oversee the cause of City Gospel Mission in recovery. Just to give you a little background of that, I've been here for 22 years, well, 23 really. I started this program in my own home in 1997 in Evanston in Cincinnati. And then in 1998, City Gospel Mission approached me because they wanted a recovery home themselves. And they had heard about this little African-American girl that had did 17 and a half years in and out of prison and was doing really great work for the community and giving back after being out of prison for about 5 years. And so they approached me, we talked, dated for about a year, and then I merged with them in 1999.
Your official title is Vice President of Recovery. And what all does that involve, or what are your main responsibilities?
It involves working with the men and women of recovery services. That means we have a men's program of Exodus, which we can house up to 36 men in one facility. And then we have a Promised Land facility that we can house another 12. So that is a total of 48. Then we have our women's program. We have three homes, New Beginning, Eve House, and Ruth and Naomi, which is our Promised Land for them. And we can house up to 34 women. Then we have two permanent supportive housing called Living Hope. Those are apartment complexes, and we can house up to four families in one unit and three families in another. I have a team of 25 life coaches, clinical directors, working with women and men coming from poverty and despair and some other issues as well, you know, social injustice, racism, barriers that they have had to approach. And so we really try to give them the services and the education in seven areas of change to educate them and empower them to go back into the community and be the best version of themselves that they can be, even trying to navigate through the systemic systems of this world.
Wow. We're going to focus this first season on diversity, equity, and inclusion in the workplace. But before we get into that with regards to your work, can you share a little bit about how you see those things and what it means to you personally?
With equality, about 1998, when I came to City Gospel Mission, I'm going to be honest with you, a lot of the African-American churches that, you know, I am an African-American girl, so I was going to a predominantly African-American church, and I had a pastor that had been a mentor to me. And when I went to him about the opportunity, the first thing that this one pastor said to me was, "No, don't go with that white organization." And I was like, "What? What are you talking about?" And he was just saying, "I just don't think it's enough diversity there. I think that they are predominantly white people believing they can put on capes and fly into the African-American population and community and save us. They don't include us. They don't involve us. And I think you going over there, they're just going to kind of rape you of your vision and your ideas. And then they're going to make them their own. And you're going to get lost in the shuffle." And I just had never really heard that. If you look at my background has always been about survival. So I had been in the criminal justice system. And so I learned how to survive. What he was saying to me was like, "Ain't nobody gonna take my stuff and do nothing to me." And yet now that I've been here 20 something years later, I think I understand it more today than I did then. And I had zeal, but no wisdom. And what he was saying to me was, "It's going to be harder. And the only reason it's going to be harder because you are African-American, you are a woman, and you're going into an organization that has been focused, even in the community, they may have been focused on the poor, but they were ran at the top by pretty much predominant white counterparts."
it sounds like it creates either a perception or a truth that the relationship between City Gospel Mission and the Black community has some tensions that your community was warning you about.
Exactly. Because they didn't see City Gospel Mission as really coming in and being inclusive as much as they were the heroes, that they had all the answers.
You talked about when you first came in, you were warned about diversity or the lack thereof, and you've been here over 20 years now. So how do you consider diversity in your work, and how do you try to impact your work with volunteers and participants and even staff through that?
I am very intentional. You got to realize when I started this ministry, it was a ministry that predominantly focused on incarceration and crack cocaine. The population that we served back then was predominantly African Americans. That's who was in prison, right? When you look at the percentage of prison incarcerations, a majority is African American people.
They're a small percentage of the population. They're disproportionately incarcerated, particularly
exactly.
in Ohio. Yeah.
And so coming from Ohio with all the prisons, a lot of the women that was coming into the program were African American. And then they were coming from prison from having been strung out on crack cocaine. They caught a case with a little bit of crack and then they went to prison for 3 years. That meant that predominantly my staffing was African-American. And maybe it was my own biases, but I really worked a lot with African-American. I would say the recovery program in its whole, if you look at the organization, I believe, and I could be wrong in numbers, but I think we probably have the most African-American in our causes, because maybe I'm like-minded and this is kind of how people wanted to come work in that area. And so they did. And it was more women because we were serving women. And then as I have moved on in throughout the organization and gotten, you know, promoted to VP and focused more on the organization and not just my cause, I became the only woman on an all-male leadership team. And it was like that for a while. And then we had another woman that come on and she's been on there with me now for a while. She's a Caucasian woman. And then we had another woman come on later, which is African American. And yet for, I would say the first 7-8 years, I was it. I was the only woman sitting at the table. It still is more men than it is women. So we have, with one of the women leaving now, we have 10 people on the leadership, and so we have 8 male. We have 3 African-American men now, when before it wasn't that way, and the rest is Caucasian.
Right, so it was 3 African-American males until William Reeves joined this year, who is the Vice President of Administration. So now we have 4 African-American males on the leadership team, you as an African-American female, we have an additional white female, and then 4 white males that make up the leadership team. That leans a little bit into the next topic, inclusion. What ways has your experience with inclusion or the lack of inclusion in your life impacted the work that you have with volunteers, participants, or staff?
With volunteers, I need to say this as a kudos to the white culture, is that they've always came in groves to serve. Always. Not so much African-American people. And I don't know what that's about either, why we can't seem to have more of a diversity in that culture of volunteers. But when it comes to church partnerships and volunteers, whites outnumber the African-American in groves. And I'm not sure about why that is like that, but it's always been like that since I've been here.
Now, when you say that, are you speaking specifically to City Gospel Mission or volunteerism in general?
Do you think that we City Gospel Mission. I don't have another experience of other. I'm not just talking about recovery. I'm talking about City Gospel Mission as a whole, of a whole organization.
Gotcha.
I think that we have more white counterparts volunteering than we do African Americans. I'm just not understanding why that is and why we as African Americans don't get involved. And I don't know if it's because of the perception in the community about City Gospel Mission, because I don't think that our heritage and our culture believe that they would embrace us and really value what we bring to the table. I think that might be what it is. I'm not really sure. I think we should really probably do some surveys and find out.
Yeah. You know, if I'm going to choose to volunteer, I would choose, and this brings us back to inclusion, I would choose to volunteer at a place where I would feel included and welcomed. And if exactly. there's a perception by some in the Black community that CGM is not inclusive to volunteers with their background, then why would they volunteer there versus something that's maybe more
exactly.
welcoming?
Exactly. So that's, I've always wondered that, like, I think my mindset has always been, how can we get more inclusive with the African-American community and neighborhoods? How can we be more intentional? Mm-hmm. How can we really build those relationships up to create trust, that they can trust that we're not some white organization that's just going to come in and tell them that we know better than they do on how to raise their children and how to do it, you know, because I think that that is some of the concepts of what has happened over in, you know, 400 years ago in slavery. And, you know, that's just that concept of the African-American race.
Well, and not even 400 years ago, right? You've got experiments like the Tuskegee experiment.
Exactly.
So there is a very reasonable distrust, I think, from 400 years of history.
Exactly.
I guess what you're talking about is continually looking within our organization, how do we overcome those barriers to become a more inclusive volunteer environment?
Exactly. Exactly. Because when it comes to participants, I'm going to be honest, I'm going to say this, and I hope I'm just going to be 100 here. In about 2005, the population, culture, and participants changed. I started getting more Caucasian women and men. They just start coming in grows. And I think now, 15 years later, I know why, because opiate use was coming back, and it just gradually creeped back in. And so they were referring them to me. And I'm going to be honest, because I'm such a realist, I treat people the same. It don't matter what your color is. I'm going to tell you the truth. What I found out is they trained me that I had to be a little more sensitive. They would act impatient, meaning a participant would act impatient. And I would say to them, you know, I don't know why you've been impatient with me. When that dope man told you, stand on the corner and wait for 10 hours, you waited. And you didn't say nothing to him. Whatever he asked you to do is what you did, and now I'm asking you to do this, and you act like I'm asking you to commit a crime. So I would say that to him, right? That's African-American. She get with it, like, you right. Okay, Ms. McCready, you right. I say that to a white girl. She looking at me like, who you think you talking to like that? What do you mean? That's not appropriate. I said, no, I'm not asking you if it's appropriate. I'm asking, was it true? And they'd be like, well, yeah, it might be true, but that ain't how you talk to people that's in recovery. That ain't how you do it. That's disrespectful. I said, who told you it was disrespectful? But what they were training me is that we had learned as an African-American population to understand the cruelty sometimes or the harshness of truth, where they had been pampered in their lives on how the truth was told. So they began to really give me some education on what entitlement was. I didn't even know what that word was. Ain't nobody entitled up in here. We all dope fiends. What do you mean? But then I start realizing that they were training me on their culture as they began to come in, and I began to see some of the language. I can still say the same thing to them. I just got to say it differently. And that was like amazing to me. And then I would see the difference in the culture of our population. And so if you had the African-American people, they would, and it was so amazing to see this, these dynamics in the group. The African-American, like if I mess with you and I'm an African-American, I might get with you. But then if white culture, if you mess with them, they all get with you. They would defend each other where we didn't defend each other. If it was one-on-one, two African-Americans getting into it, then it was just them two African-Americans. But if an African-American girl and a white woman got into it, then all of them would jump on the Black girl. They teamed up. And if they wanted to get you out of there, they would come up with a strategic plan. So to me, it was like systemic racism. They knew how to approach it in a way from their experiences, how to execute it, the power, the privilege. You know what I'm saying? Even if they didn't have to even like each other, but they knew how to come together because they were taught that nobody comes against ours. But nobody taught the African-American that you should stand up. We lived in scarcity and fear. And so they start teaching me the stuff that I was warned about years ago. Now I start seeing it. This is what they're talking about. This is what it means from inclusion, diversity. I start seeing these things play out right before my eyes.
It sounds like what you're describing is you first perceived it to be cultural differences, but the more that you witnessed how the dynamics depended upon race in those interactions, the more it highlighted to you this systemic way of living and existing in our culture that says, well, this person can talk to me this way, but this person cannot. And
exactly.
And so to be able to continue to do your ministry, you had to fundamentally minister to that.
I did. I had to make adjustments.
Yeah.
Because they were starting to complain about me. All those years that I did the same thing, I served a different culture, a different, you know, ethnicity. Nobody ever complained about Miss Secreta. But then I got this new group and they began to like go to Roger and talk to the volunteers and say, you know, she talks to us all crazy and, you know, and it's like, what? And then the African-American women were like, that's just who she is. She keep it at 100. They began to show me, I can't say this to them. I can say it. I just got to find a new language. Does that make sense?
It does make sense. And I think it leans into the equity side of things. Is this equitable treatment? Is this how you do equity in your program? Or do you feel like it looks like equity, but maybe it's supporting existing systems that you must work around because you can't eliminate them right now?
Exactly. And that's what I felt like was happening. And I was getting a lot of backlashing. I was always in Roger's office, which is the president of the ministry. Was like somebody's complaining about Lucreta's attitude. I believe I've been called to do it. I know the population I'm serving, they want to have their way, whether they Black, white, Hispanic. They coming in this program, I'm going to treat them with godliness and respect, and yet I'm going to hold them accountable and I'm going to tell them the truth. And I'm sorry if someone in their lives has enabled them to hear the truth, and that's why they're in the condition they're in. This ain't the program for them. I had to learn. You know, some of my ways, I'm street. I came from the streets. And I came from a place of my own pain of protecting myself and surviving. So some of it, I had to go in and realize some things, Karen. The Bible talks about sharing the truth and love. I had to learn some of those things because I was just keeping it 100, this is how it's going to be. And I learned that keeping it 100 ain't just about telling the truth. It's how you tell it. I had to learn how to savor my truth. And I think it was not just about African-American and white. It was about people in general. It was about humanity. When I deal with people, I deal with humanity. You know what I mean? I see the color. I ain't a lot. I see the different backgrounds. But I ask God to teach me how to work with the hearts of humanity. What does this heart that you have created need? And how do I need to operate? Even my staffing, I was intentional to bring on some Caucasian women and men. Oh, I'm intentional. So I had to get intentional about my staffing and about my volunteers. And now I'm really working hard at intentionally bringing African-American volunteers on board. I'm intentional now.
Equity often refers to the fair and respectful treatment of all people, which is what you're describing. And I think one of the things that you're talking about in that diversity of staff and volunteers is the importance of those individuals' life experiences in ministering to the participants in your program, right? Because when you have, for instance, like you described early on, an all-white staff ministering in large part to an all-Black participant population, there's big gaps in understanding of life experience and a lack of diversity for them to be able to understand one another. So it sounds like that's what you're doing, is you're being very, very intentional about working inclusion and equity into your ministry.
I've realized that I need to have a certain amount of diversity in my team. I realized that we can't tell people how to experience us. And so your experience is not my experience, and my experience is not their experience. Trying to really bring education to the participants too, because sometimes they will say, more the African-Americans that will speak up, that feel like that they see privilege and biases towards the Caucasian male, especially in our men's program. We hear a lot of that. They feel like it ain't fair. They feel like people favor them. They get to do more stuff. So, and then I have to look around who's leading it, right? So when I look around and see who's leading, then I realize they might have some justification. Because that person, if he's a Caucasian male leading this, then what's happening is that that person is leaning more towards his kind, even if he's unconsciously biased about it.
You're looking at the circumstances and you're trying to really train your staff and volunteers on recognizing the biases that they don't even know they have.
Exactly. And showing them that you may not even think you're doing that, but listen to what that person said. You can't tell me that they can't feel that way if they see you letting so-and-so have a car and he in phase three, but then when he asks for a car, you tell him he got to wait to phase four. Well, nobody should have got a car till they was in phase four. Why did you let that person have it? And then they'll come up with many excuses of why. And it's like, no, that don't make no good sense. The reason that you go with the principles and practices is that it keeps everybody with equality. And I understand that you don't throw the baby out with the bathwater, and sometimes you may have to make adjustments. But when you make those flexible adjustments, be able to explain it to everyone in a rational way that makes good sense. And then we can discern whether or not it's feelings versus privilege.
Which sounds like humility is a really important component of your staff, to be able to look at how they're interacting with people who've had different life experiences and listen to the feedback that says, maybe you've got a bias that you were unaware of, and to just in humility say, you're right, and I'm going to change what I'm doing.
Exactly, exactly. And so just trying to teach them that, and that's been a really big piece of, since I have come up, I was so ingrained in the day-to-day, and I have not been for like 5 years now. I'm still on top of it, though. You got my hand on the pulse. I know what's going on. I don't have to know all the details, but the discernment of, I can walk in the environment care, whether it's downstairs on Dalton or whether it's on Gaithy, I can walk in and tell what the atmosphere is telling me. And they'll ask me, like, how did you know that was going on? Nobody ever told me. I said, because I walk in, I sit in the atmosphere, and the atmosphere tells me what's going on there. I talk to my team about what's going on. Why is this atmosphere feeling like they're not trusting, they're not conflict, there's something underlining going on, even if they are sitting all at the table looking like they're cute. Why is it that the atmosphere is telling me they're struggling?
Is there anything else about your work or about you that you'd like to share with us before we wrap up?
I have learned over the 22 years of working in this organization that this organization's got a lot of growth to do. I think that when I say growth, meaning developmentally aware and consciously aware of the biases and the underlining, it don't have to be systemic racism, but it's systemic. I'm learning, the Bible talks about be in this world, but not of it. We can have layers of systemic idealistic things that we've done, and they may have worked, but if we're not willing to tear down the pattern of those things and be open to other ways of doing them, I think that we can really have the best intentions and have the worst outcomes.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
It does. And I think it points to what I believe I know about you, Lucreta, and your heart for God first, and for seeing lives transformed through Jesus Christ, that, you know, to your point, it's not necessarily about focusing on the systems, but when we see them and we address those issues, we're able to minister more holistically.
Exactly. And I think that I've been the mad Black woman here. I've been, oh my God, Lucreta this, Lucreta that. And maybe I was. And some of my stuff came from my own pain and what I've experienced. And yet what I also believe in, I believe in balance. I believe in rhythms. I believe in principles and practices. And I believe in people saying, let they yay be yay and they nay be nay. Don't be coming to me saying one thing and doing another. I don't do that too well. I'm just saying, let us say if we got core operational behaviors, let us act out of those. Let us be consistent. If we say that we're going to do something and we're really going to be equitable about how we treat people and what we do, let's put our hands on the table. Let's not put the hands on the table and put the other hand in the back of your back so nobody can see it. Let's just be honest. You know, say what you mean and mean what you say. And when people don't do that for me, it bothers the heck out of me. Or when you try to see, instead of holding people accountable to the exact nature of their choices. Come on, like they made that choice. Hold them to it, but then you're gonna try to pamper it like it's not just, it's so many things I just wanna say for real. I have had so many experiences that I have felt in my own walk here that I've grown, and yep, it's gone through some pain care. I felt like I was treated differently. I don't believe that they intentionally did it. I just think they unconsciously made decisions about stuff, whether it was, I'm gonna just give you an example. I say, can I raise my salary? You say, no, I can't raise my salary. But then I find out later you've been letting a white boy raise his salary. And then when I bring it to your attention, you're gonna say to me, oh, well, I'm sorry. I didn't know it was happening. I didn't know that was happening. And then you're going to try to appease me now and say, well, you can go do it, Laquita. You can go do it. No, what you need to do is go back to him and say he can't do it, and then let him choose if he wants to stay or go. And the only reason I would even found that out is because this person wanted to come to my department. And I know God exposes everything. And so when I found it out, it was like I had did something wrong. And I'm like, no, you told me I couldn't do it, but you let this person go do it. That's not equitable, right?
What you're describing are barriers that are possibly invisible to certain individuals in the organization that haven't experienced that. And they don't even necessarily know that they're creating those barriers. But how do we move forward as an organization when we do recognize them?
Because that person said that he needed to make this amount, right? So then they allow him to go raise so he can make what he wants so they can have him. But then when I say, can I go raise my salary? Because I want to make a certain amount. You tell me no. Your words are, because I know your potential, you be making more than anybody in here. Wow. But I don't know that he's doing that over here when I ask my question. Then when I find out, then I bring the paper to the table. And now we're going to try to, let's smooth it over with Laquita. It's like, no, you was over there doing that when I asked you. And then the person said they didn't know. Because when you don't have your hand on the pulse of the thing, anything can happen. You can't tell me how to experience that. That was hurtful.
Yeah. Do you feel like there's been changes that have taken place since that experience that show you we're moving towards better awareness and more equitable treatment of staff? Or
I do believe that we're trying to be more transparent and be open. And I think that that was corrected. That was, maybe it was an isolated situation. And I want to believe that. But I think since then, I think we as an organization has said, okay, I want to be better. And so let's try to be as equitable as we can. And let's be as honest as we can. And if we don't know, we don't know. But let's try to figure out what everybody's doing so we can keep all hands on the table.
One last question I have for you is, what do you hope for in the future for City Gospel Mission and this work that we're doing?
Well, I hope that we live to be 100, which is 4 years from now, I hope. But my bigger issue is that we will all that sit at the table as leaders would be raising up other people of value and importance and worth to be able to take this work to the next generation with different experience, different colors, different sexes, you know, and really be open that we know that we are passing the baton to great, innovative, God-loving, fearing, obedient, humble people of all color, creeds, race, and sex. That's what I hope.
Thank you so much for this interview, Laquita, and we hope to have you back again soon.
I hope to be back.
All right, thank you. Thank you for listening. If you like what you're hearing, make sure you subscribe to the podcast to get the latest releases. And remember Micah 6:8, act justly, love mercy, and walk humbly with your God. We'll meet you back here next time.